Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors Studio is mobile today in Williamsport, and great to have you with us. John Bacon in a few moments. Coming up, the play-by-play call of the day. We're in the Sunbury Motors Studio, 4th Street at Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Our play-by-play call today, Giancarlo Stanton gets it done again.
And Stanton swings again here. Powers the ball high and deep to left center toward the Clevelander. Leaping at the wall is Perkins. Can't get it. It's into the Clevelander. A home run for Giancarlo, his second of the night. The Marlins pulled it within a run.
Dave Van Horn with the call on the Marlins radio network. Last night's game against the Phillies. John Bacon has become a really good friend over the years. He's written a book about John Saunders. It's due out on August 10th. Of course, he wrote the book Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football, that included critical chapters about Penn State 5 years ago. And we welcome John Bacon back to the show. My friend, great to hear you.
Steve, always a pleasure, my friend. Very kind on the introduction.
Oh, no, it's an introduction you deserve after all. You and I have covered a few miles together, my friend.
Right, now we have. The last 5 years have probably been more miles than most years, so
yeah,
I agree
probably.
With that.
John, I want to start actually with your book on John Saunders, which is coming out next month. Number one, what compelled you to say that's an interesting subject, which now, of course, has gone to a different level because of everything that's happened along the way, but what compelled you to say that was an interesting subject?
More a gut reaction, Steve, than any logical assessment of the marketplace or any of that stuff. John and I were friends since, I think, 1998 when we played hockey together in some charity outing. John played college hockey, actually. He was quite good, a guy from Montreal, which a lot of folks didn't know. We stayed in touch, and then after John had this bad fall, this accident, in 2011, where he stood up too fast, blacked out, fell backwards, and was unconscious for a while. He had to go into the hospital for 6 weeks to relearn how to walk and talk and read and write. And that, of course, brought on some depression, which got scary for a while, and he came out of that. And when he did, we started talking about doing this as a book. And I just thought, on faith, yeah, let's do this. And for 4 years, we worked without a contract or the promise of one. We finally got one, and it all worked out pretty well. And then, tragically, John died of natural causes in August of last year. But it was not, I can assure you, Steve, a rational decision. When I met you for the first time in 2012, and I'm there to follow the Penn State team during that amazing season, that was obviously a national story that I thought, when you take the player's perspective, you'd have a real feel-good story. This was purely on faith.
Yeah, purely on faith. But along the way, everyone has their own story, and within that story, there are certain elements that no one realizes until it's revealed. What in John's story did he reveal along the way to you that you hadn't realized that also took you aback?
Well, I knew probably more than most just from talking to John over the years in more, I guess, confidential ways than he'd talk with his colleagues, because I didn't work at ESPN, of course. Nonetheless, when he gets into his story, even his best friends, Bob Lee and Chris Berman, guys I know you know, at ESPN all those years, they knew John, they felt as well as anybody, and they had no idea that John grew up with physical abuse, sexual abuse, self-medication, drugs and whatnot, self-mutilation, a history of concussions, and a history of depression that at times would get very, very severe. And John, you'd never guess when you met him, and you probably have many times. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you meet him, and that's not phony. He was outgoing, friendly, sincere, down to earth, all those great things. It just was not the whole story.
No, it was not the whole story. And at one point, and depression can drive anybody to this, at one point he considered maybe taking his own life.
more than once, actually, in the time we focus on in the book that we start the book with. In 2011, 2012, about 6 months after this bad accident, he said that, and this applies to what we do, Steve, in the football world. We talk a lot about concussions and whatnot, and John made clear, look, concussions don't make you depressed. Losing your faculties, your short-term memory, your ability to do certain things, and not knowing if you're ever going to get that ability back, said that will make you depressed. It's not the same thing. And that's what John was dealing with when he tried to come back too soon on ESPN and made a lot of mistakes on air. And Steve, poor you and me, we know that these days when you make a mistake on air, there'll be 10 of your friends on Twitter to tell you all about it. And that was a new world for John. So that was getting him down. And that's where he had suicidal thoughts. I guess the positive part of the story, and there's more positive than negative for sure, is that depression is, A, it's a disease. It's not just, you don't just snap out of it. So if you have it, get help and get your friends' help. Two, it's very treatable. In the vast majority of cases, you will, it'll get much better or you will come out of it entirely. But you got to get help, and that's one of John's big messages. The reason it's written from John's point of view, he's on a train with Joe Biden, the former vice president, after a conference on mental health at the White House with Bradley Cooper from the Playbook movie, of course, Glenn Close and others. Biden said, you know, you can come out as a gay football or basketball player these days, and it's less of a big deal than coming out with depression, because nobody ever has during their careers. It's amazing. And John realized that this is what his role has to be. Military guys, athletes, African-Americans are three groups that are least likely to get help when they face this, which is why, sadly, after all this nonstop war we've had, that many of those people have committed suicide, and one reason why is they don't get help. So that is the message.
All right, thank you. He is a trailblazer, and I wish John was around for this victory lap, basically, to get this embrace from the world. People who've read it already, Adam Schefter, Bob Lee, Chris Berman, have already gushed about it because John was utterly forthcoming. And it takes a breakthrough guy like that to do it. John had almost nothing to gain by writing this book. I mean, the money you make from a book ain't what they pay you at ESPN these days. So it's not the money, and as far as fame goes, I believe John had that. So what you're going to lose is your privacy, basically, and not just yours, but also, to a degree, that of your family and your brother and so on. So you had to talk to them first as well and get their approval. But he wanted to do it for two reasons. One is he wanted to come clean himself and have that catharsis. And two, he wanted to help as many people as he could. That he felt was the one big thing he could do in his role as a well-known sportscaster, is to get the word out. So in that sense, we, after John passed away and we'd finished what we thought was a near final draft, John's wife, his brother, and I all decided, look, we got to do this. This is exactly what John wanted, and we know he wanted this. So let's finish it up. And so far, the response has been very positive.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I can't wait to sit down and read it myself. I've got to get into the five-year anniversary of the sanctions coming down. You were there and were embedded. This is when you were trying to look at Ohio State, Northwestern, Michigan, Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
As you're going through all of this and putting it together, now you look back on 5 years, where Penn State is now compared to where this began. What is your thought and your impression?
Well, I'll say this as loudly as I can, and I'm sure the NCAA will not listen, because they never have, that the quote-unquote culture at Penn State is as strong as ever. And that is why Penn State is in the recovery process, if you will. The football program seems to be almost where it was 5 years ago, basically. The recruiting has been fantastic under Franklin. They are, what, top 10 team last year? The world has kind of righted itself. Obviously, you've got court cases. You've got jail time. It's not, you know, it's a serious business. It's not just about football. But I've never heard anybody, I have to tell you this, Steve, and we've talked about this before, nobody I've ever talked to associated with Penn State, a fan of Penn State, has ever made light of Sandusky or the situation that is all brought in. But the separation has to be made between the people who are responsible and the players and the team. And that's what I focused on, Mike Motti and Zordich and those guys, guys you love, I love, and other fans love. And in that sense, it was the culture when the whole world was against them that stayed strong throughout, and that culture is what you see today. Now, I think that on that front, the old Michigan athletic director, Don Canham, had the best line on PR I have ever heard, and it's this: never turn a one-day story into a two-day story. My advice to the leaders of Penn State is this thing has been put to rest. The ruins have come down and all the rest. Let all that go and call that good. Get back to being Penn State full blast, and that culture is very strong, and you see it on the field and off the field.
I don't know if I've ever asked you this question before, because you were working with three other programs at the time. You know, so you do a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit there. As this was happening to Penn State, in the other three programs that you were working with and embedded with, what was their reaction to what was going on at that particular time here?
I can tell you this. That's a great question, by the way, and nobody ever asked me that in the entire book tour. So good for you, Steve. As usual, you always get a few in there that no one else ever thought of. That at Northwestern, Michigan, Ohio State, even Michigan State, I spent some time there, even Notre Dame, not one person inside those programs who run those programs and those departments and those universities, none of them wagged their finger, sat in judgment, clucked their tongues, any of that. Almost all of them had the same reaction, which was, there but for the grace of God go we. In a campus that has 40,000 employees, something like that, you just knock on wood and hope to God that everyone behaves themselves, basically. And if they don't, you hope the people in charge, you know, do the right things as fast as they can. So there was no smugness whatsoever from the other programs that I detected. What they did have, from the football point of view, is a great deal of respect to Bill O'Brien, of course, then the coach of the team, but especially the seniors. It's not that often that you know seniors outside the program as senior leaders, but the whole Big Ten knew Mike Motti and Mike Zordich, thanks to ESPN and other things like that. But man, you talk to Coach Fitzgerald, you talk to D'Antonio, talk to Urban Meyer about the guys on Penn State's team, and they knew exactly the kind of players they wanted on their team. In the book, the longest quote in the book, as the longest quote I've ever used from anybody, goes about a page, and it's from Urban Meyer, and it's about the Penn State-Ohio State game of 2012. And he said, look at that game for a minute. You know, we're on probation, they're on probation. We're not going to a Big Ten title game, they're not going either. We're not going to a bowl game, they're not going either. We're both having the whole country turn their backs on us. We're dealing with all this crap. And yet, in that game, what do you see? A packed house at Penn State, a whiteout, a great night game, and not one player on either team took a single play off. What are they fighting for? They're fighting for their teammates, their classmates, their school, the lettermen, the alumni, the fans. They're fighting for all the things you love about college football, nothing more. He said that was a great example of the spirit of college football. And when he finished that quote, I looked to his PR guy, Jerry Amig, a guy I'm sure you know, and I said, damn. I can't say it any better than that. And as Mark Twain said, Steve, if the guy said it better than you can, quote him. So that's what I did. And that was the typical reaction to what Penn State was doing at that time.
Amazing. And, yeah, John, we go back to, I'll tell you, the documentary I really enjoy is Tiebreaker, and you're in it a lot. And something that really, you remember you said Don Canham said don't make a one-day story, a two-day story?
Oh, yeah.
Tiebreaker is a four-decade story.
I might quote you on that, Steve. I'm afraid you're right. That's 43, 44 years ago. And Mike Lantry, the kicker in that game, is probably going to be honored this fall at Michigan Stadium, so it never dies.
Good. All right. I'm glad he will. But something that's important about that is that they've never once released what the vote is. And if they had just released the vote, they could have put a whole bunch of stuff to bed.
Exactly. And, I mean, I don't get into politics when I do sports. I know you don't either. It's a losing argument.
Right.
And I'm not going to get into politics here, but I can say when you look at the campaigns, both campaigns the last year and a half, man, don't turn a one-day story into a two-day story. Take your medicine, you know, bite the bullet, and be done with it. And you'll take a hit, but it'll be short, and we get over it very quickly. And when I consult with corporations about this stuff, I say, look, apologies in the press are incredibly boring. This guy shows up, we screwed up, we did X, Y, and Z, we're going to fix it, here's how. We go, huh, we write it down, and as you know, Steve, we walk away. Next story. Somebody else somewhere is going to screw up. Don't worry about it. But if you give us a cover-up, wow, that's fascinating. So that's what they did in the tiebreaker thing. To this day, this is before, of course, Penn State got, you know, started playing 20 years later in the Big Ten. But yeah, the vote was either 6-4 or 5-4-1, or we don't know what, but Ohio State got the nod to go to the Rose Bowl, which does affect Penn State, because after that they realized that it was a silly rule to have only one Big Ten team go to a bowl game, the Rose Bowl, or bust. So Michigan at 10-0-1, ranked fourth in the nation, didn't go anywhere. And for 3 years, they were 30 wins, two losses, one tie, no bowl games during that stretch. And so that changed the whole bowl picture, which is why almost every Big Ten team that can still stand at the end of the season goes to a bowl game. But those are the ripples. But, yeah, I mean, you think you're being cute and clever by trying to keep things to yourself. It rarely works.
It rarely works. We're also, I want to take just a quick glimpse. I want to get your opinion about the future of this thing, because the new Fox TV contract, along with everybody else, starts this year. But then after that, we might see Amazon, we might see, who knows what we're going to see. What do you see as the future of college sports, you know, in your mind, and these, and because the model is changing so much right now. Do we have four super conferences? Does everybody expand one more time? I, you know, because I, no offense, but I think the Big Ten, to be honest with you, might be too big. But that's just me. Now, I thought 12 was a great number, but that, you know, that's only a personal opinion. What do you think might happen with this model, that how much we love college football? You and I love it, but can they ruin it?
Yes and yes. For usual, Steve, we agree on just about everything here, different perspectives, but the same conclusions, I would say, that when Penn State was added to the Big Ten, that was a very popular addition. And I learned in the process of writing Fourth and Long, which is mainly the Penn State book, that Penn State was brought in as Northwestern insurance, because at the time, Northwestern was flirting with the Ivy League to leave the Big Ten, because they had no success for basically 15, almost 20 years. So Penn State was there in case they dropped out. I did not realize that. And then, of course, they added Nebraska about 5 years ago, also a very popular addition, and almost a counterbalance to Penn State. Very similar programs, I think, very similar cultures, very similar attitudes. I know there's a lot of respect there. And I thought, like you, 12, that gets it done. You can have your divisions, you can have your Big Ten title game. It all is contiguous. It's all similar culture. And no knock against Maryland or Rutgers, but those are not Big Ten teams. They're just not. Penn State felt like one immediately to the Big Teners. Nebraska, same thing. And again, you know, Maryland is a charter member of the ACC, and more power to them, but that's their culture, basically. So I think that was a mistake, and I think in the process you do risk alienating the hardcores. Whenever you go to a Big Ten bar, and I've been to a few, Steve, including Penn State, of course. It's all about research, Steve, all about research.
Absolutely. We all do. In fact,
thank
it's
you.
Research.
Oh, yeah, it's just hard-hitting investigative journalism. That's all that is right there.
That's right.
But anyway, on that front, you go to almost any Big Ten bar in Iowa City or State College or Madison, Wisconsin, and you will see the banners of all the schools up there. But you don't see that anymore because no one cares about Rutgers in Maryland. So there is that risk. I think on the TV front, Big Ten Network has been a great boon for the Big Ten. That's how you got Nebraska in the first place. It has, you know, made it the most lucrative conference by far in college football, college sports. And, of course, you know, Ohio State and Penn State are up there every year amongst all athletic programs, all sports, and that's one of the reasons. But I think you're right. This golden goose is getting squeezed awfully hard. And I've seen it at Penn State. I've seen it at Ohio State. And I really saw it at Michigan during the Dave Brennan era, where you're down to 60,000 fans in the stands during the end there. That's bad news. You have to understand that these college football fans are college football fans. They're fans. They're not customers. They're not clients. They are irrational. To them, it's a religion. And Ed Zetters used to be the pastor of the Methodist Church in downtown State College. Great guy. He said to me, it's part of, yeah, you know, Ed, and he said, it's part of worldwide Methodism that you need more than food and shelter to live a full life. You need values to stand for, people to stand with, and a place to stand with them. And he said, I do a pretty good job here in State College of doing that on Sundays in my church, but I can't help but notice the church down the street holds 108,000 true believers. So you better get that. We can all stay home. We can all watch on TV. You know, no line for the bathrooms. You can drink beer and everything else. So why do you drive 4, 6, 7 hours to State College? It's a religion. And don't forget that, and don't push it too hard.
One final question, John, I'll let you go. Thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, sure.
As always. You talked about Don Canham and the respect for Don Canham. I've been talking to Jim Tarman over the years, you know, Don Canham's name would come up, and Jim had such respect for him, and so did Joe. And obviously, Joe really respected Bo. You went through a period of time where it was a business model at Michigan. You mentioned Dave Brandon. Has now Michigan started to feel like, to you, Michigan again, based on where they are in the athletic department and program?
Yeah, I think much more so. They brought back Ward Manuel, who played for Bo Schembechler in the 90s, and spent his life in athletics, which I think helps. I know Sandy Barber, similar background, not a football player, of course, but a lifetime athletic department personnel employee.
Right.
That matters, I think. I think that, yeah, the business side matters, but, man, if you don't get the coaches and the fans right, it won't matter much. So it's going in the right direction, but Michigan's still not out of the woods, I would say, that you lost about 20 or 30,000 fans, maybe forever, during the Brandon era. And what I worry about with the Big Ten in general is the ticket prices are so high at the biggest schools, and again, the three biggest by far are Ohio State, Penn State, and Michigan, and Nate Silvers, the Politico, he figured out that those three schools have got more fans nationwide than the entire Pac-12. It's 3.2 million for Ohio State, 2.9 for Michigan, 2.6 for Penn State, last I checked, and that's bigger than most conferences, so it's pretty amazing. But I don't see kids very often. And I'm a kid in Ann Arbor going for $2 a game, pretty easy. Now it's, you know, a couple hundred bucks. That's, you bring a client, not a kid. And so I think that, to look out for the next generation 10, 20 years down the road, they got to make sure the kids are still involved.
So spot on. Appreciate it, John. You know we could have done this for about 3 or 4 hours.
One of these days, Jones, we will.
Yes, one of these days we will, Bacon. John, it is always a pleasure. I will hopefully talk to you very, very soon. Good luck with the book. I can't wait to read it.
Real simple, Steve. You call, I answer anytime, my friend. I always have a great time talking to you.
John Bacon. His new book on John Saunders comes out August 10th. John Wortham in the next half hour. We'll come back. News at the bottom of the hour after this on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC Way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC Way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC Way. The SMC Way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
A quick weather note for everybody out there in Lewisburg, Watsontown, Sunbury, some lightning strikes around that area in the last half hour. So just be careful as you travel around the area. The line of storms that's moving to the southeast through the area. And just be aware of that as you go through. It's also 90 degrees out there right now today as well. All right, time now for the Sports Bozo of the Day. Ladies and gentlemen, we present to you Ezekiel Elliott, Dallas Cowboys, embroiled in a league-sanctioned domestic violence investigation and may or may not have been involved in an altercation at a Dallas bar over the weekend, is now appealing a misdemeanor conviction for speeding. Elliott's Dodge Charger was not clocked at 72, 80, 90, 100. It was clocked at 105 miles an hour. Back in April, late June, Elliott entered a plea of no contest to the speeding charge, thus waiving the right to a trial. His plea was accepted on July 5th, but an appeal was then filed again on the 14th. A speeding ticket for going 35 miles an hour over the speed limit, the speed limit there was 70, is not troubling in itself, but at this point, the pattern of continual trouble and misbehavior with the NFL's leading rusher has to be considered. And while under investigation for domestic violence, Elliott has visited a Seattle marijuana shop, pulled down a woman's shirt while on the top of a parade float, potentially been involved in a bar altercation, and was clocked at 105 in his car. The latest of these incidents came after he claimed that he was just trying to learn to stay out of the way. Well, whatever he's been doing hasn't been working. The NFL, by the way, still delivering whether or not that Elliott and whether or not they will suspend him or not. And there's a possibility he could be on a suspension list for a brief period of time. We'll see. Then there is this story. As you know, O.J. Simpson has his parole hearing coming up on Thursday. It is going to be nationally televised. CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, ESPN, maybe even the over-the-air networks are going to air his parole hearing. You can actually online make wagers at overseas casinos on whether he gets parole or not. What? One thing that's also interesting that actually works in his favor is that on the list, you have to put down whether or not you had been convicted of a previous crime. And he, of course, can put no because he wasn't convicted. You can actually bet with overseas markets on whether or not he gets parole on Thursday or not. Now, what's fascinating to me about this is that if you are in college and you're a senior in college, you weren't born when this happened. The murders took place, tragically, 23 years ago. The trial and the conclusion of it was 22 years ago. If you are in college, you were not born when this happened. And, of course, O.J. went beyond football. You're talking about media, commercials, acting. But you can actually place a wager, on whether or not he gets parole on Thursday. And it's going to be nationally televised. Remember, he's in jail for 33 years on the initial conviction that took place with that incident at a Las Vegas hotel.
in which he said he was trying to get his memorabilia back that he claimed was stolen from him. But that is amazing. And you can actually, I mean, we always talk about how you can bet on anything. You can now bet on whether a guy gets parole. By the way, if he does get paroled, he would be out October 1st. But that is the story on OJ. That comes up on Thursday, which, by the way, is our next show. We're not going to have a show tomorrow. Tomorrow, we have Phillies baseball with the Miami Marlins to close out the series on getaway day in Miami. So we'll have the Phillies on tomorrow. First pitch at 12:10 tomorrow. We'll come back on Thursday. Thursday's show will have our good friend from Spotlight Ticket Management, Tony Knopp. We'll talk about the business of sports. Tony Knopp, business of sports, Thursday, 3 to 5, News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right. John Wertheim, of course, years now has worked his way through at Sports Illustrated to the top spot. If there's a primary beat that John works on, it's actually the tennis beat along the way. But he is the one that is the leader of Sports Illustrated at what is a very difficult time. I mean, SI is at a point where they've gone from 51 issues down to 45 issues. This year they're doing 35 issues, and now there's word they might next year do 24. It's not an easy time for the magazine. But we had a wide variety of things to talk about, especially on the business side with John, and had a chance to talk with him.
All right, John, let's get to you wrote, I thought, a very compelling piece about ESPN, where it is, where it's going. What are a couple of elements along the way that you either figured out, heard about, that really took you in the direction that you went in with your article?
Well, I mean, I think most of us in our media consumption kind of, we see it ourselves in our own homes. We spend more time on our phones and less time watching cable, and that's got to have an impact. I mean, I think that the notion of the whole cable bundle of sort of this is what you get and this is what you're paying for, and if you don't want to watch the Discovery Channel or ESPN, too bad, you're paying for it anyway. that's not the great, you know, asking people to pay for something they don't want is not a great sustainable business model. And we see what's happening with ESPN and the whole cable model, and we see how that could potentially trickle down to rights fees. And the point I was trying to make is that the NFL, the NBA, these pro leagues, if cable rights fees start to decline, there are a lot of ways to make that up. They can find digital partners, they can change their business, they can pay the players less, they can go into Asia and find new markets. I mean, this is normal businesses. They can find ways to offset decline. College sports is a completely different animal. And you don't pay the players, and because of Title IX, you can't start cutting the unprofitable arms of your business. And a lot of these athletic departments, most of them, in fact, are running at a deficit right now. It's not like they're sitting on these huge piles of cash. And if these rights fees start to go away in college sports, that could really have a big, big impact in a way that I think is separate from the way it might impact the NFL or the NBA.
And is that where Amazon and others along the way, those in the tech world, Silicon Valley, have hit it big, could they possibly be a collegiate answer?
You know, I guess. I mean, we'll see. First of all, it's great that you have these streaming options that are going to come into play. I mean, I think this NFL season will be really interesting, but they're not paying, you know, network prices. They're not paying, you know, ESPN's paying over $100 million a game for Monday Night Football. Those are not near the numbers that, you know, Amazon and Twitter and Facebook are paying for streaming rights. I mean, it's pennies on the dollar right now. I think those digital numbers will come up, but right now it's like saying we're going to take that full page ad in the local newspaper and we're going to get a banner ad, you know, on the Pittsburgh Post Gazette website. I mean, that's not a one for one dollar transfer. But I also think that, you know, NFL streaming, NFL is going to be fine. It's a popular product. There's a scarcity. To me, you know, the college sports picture is going to look very different. I mean, I don't know how many people are watching, you know, streaming you tell that Big Ten diving or I go on these conference networks sometimes and I'm thinking, I'm paying for the Washington State softball game that's airing right now, and I can't imagine there are many people interested in this programming. So I think the digital streaming will probably happen for big popular events like NFL games, and that's high value, that's a premium event. Is that going to happen for the Penn State baseball game? I don't know.
What's interesting about it is that obviously you're in a business where you have to take care of the current but then look to the future as well. That's part of what you do. Did ESPN, even though there was new competition in the market, did they misgauge the future of where things are? And I'm thinking mostly about the NBA contract.
Yeah, I had someone tell me that was privy to that contract. They said if that deal were being done today, it would be being done at 30% less, the price tag. And that was not even a year and a half ago. And the one thing I keep hearing again and again is that in about 2012, ESPN thought it was going to have this competition from Fox Sports 1 and from the NBC Sports Network and from some of these other rights that were going to come open. And they probably overpaid for a lot of the inventory out there just to sort of take it off the market, just to make sure that these competitors didn't get it. And so they were probably looking a little bit too much at their competition in terms of other networks and probably not hard enough at the trends that were coming in terms of this switch to digital. So things like, you mentioned the NBA, you look at what they paid for ESPN. I mean, look at what ESPN paid for Monday Night Football, which are not usually compelling games. And the other thing, there's no Super Bowl. I mean, the other three networks get a Super Bowl at the end of the day. So they may have a blah slate of games, but at least one every 3 years they have the most popular broadcast night in TV. I mean, ESPN doesn't get that Super Bowl out of it. And there's a sense that right around 2012-2013 is when there was a lot of overpayment of these rights deals that are long-term deals. And now they're sort of, they're facing declining revenues and they're locked into these long-term rights contracts. That backs you into a corner.
Yeah, the ESPN Monday Night deals $1.9 billion for the regular season, another $100 million for a playoff game, a single playoff game. So that's $2 billion a year for 17 games.
That's amazing.
I want to ask you about the next contracts up will be the NFL, Major League Baseball, and ironically, the last one in college negotiated, the Big Ten, will be the first one up the next time. What will those three contracts, you think, tell us to give us a gauge as to what the next 5 to 10 years after that will look like in sports negotiating?
That's a great question. I think what we're going to see is some of those contracts looking differently, not just in dollar amounts, but how they're structured. And maybe they're structured differently so that there's more ability to sell the digital. It's sort of the Thursday night football game seemed to be the big guinea pig right now. I just don't know. I mean, the Big Ten next year, Big Ten schools are going to get about $44 million in conference revenues. That's a big, big number for the majority of athletic departments. That may be half the revenues of an athletic department before they've sold a single ticket or done their own licensing deal. If that number slips, and these athletic departments aren't operating at a profit right now under these numbers, and they may have to face the specter of paying salaries to student athletes, if I'm a Big Ten athletic director right now, I'm really thinking long and hard about my next budget.
Because Texas just put in lockers at $10,500 per. Auburn just put in a video board, and Clemson's got a fun park inside their locker room facility. How prudent do you think athletic departments have to be thinking about the fact that the bubble might burst?
We have this arms race right now, especially in football, but it's really all sports. I mean, if you talk to some of these, the golf team is doing a spring trip to New Zealand, and you're sort of thinking, they don't have, this is a non-revenue sport by definition. They're not selling tickets, and you've got a traveling party of 15 crossing oceans. I mean, how long can this last? Football is obviously driving the bus, and football is where the revenue is, and at some of these schools that have the private private jets for recruiting, or that have the Clemson water park and bowling alley, or the, I saw YouTube of the Oklahoma facility, they would say, listen, this is an expense. We need to field a competitive team, and this is what recruits want. But at some point, there's going to be a reckoning, I think, in college sports, because it's just not a sustainable model.
One final question, John, because I know you have a meeting you have to get to, and we're very aware of that. And it deals with regional networks. Regional networks are really important to the NHL, the NBA is an addition, and really to Major League Baseball. If there's an unbundling, what might happen to regional networks and the revenue they can provide?
When you talk to experts, they say the first networks to go are these RSNs, these regional sports networks. I mean, the amount of money that the cable subscriber pays compared to the viewership is just a huge, vast variance. And someone was telling me, I think we're using it as an example, the RSN in San Diego that has the Padres games. And they said, look, everyone in the area pays for it. The ratings for these games are minuscule. If they did this on an a la carte basis, so only, you know, you pay for it only if you want it, they would have to charge about $1,000 a month for each subscriber. That's how big the differential is between the revenues they're getting from cable subscription fees and the actual viewership. I think if you're depending on RSNs for your revenue in an era of unbundling, in an era of only pay for what you want, those are what I've told again and again. Those are some of the most perilous networks right now. I mean, ESPN will be interesting. I mean, are people going to, if ESPN tripled their price, would you pay for it? You know, I probably would, but I don't know if there are enough of me out there to offset the loss that they would take.
Many more questions. Great conversation. John, thank you so much for the time. I know you have something else you have to get to.
You got it. Enjoyed that. Thanks.
John Wertheim, Executive Editor, Sports Illustrated.
We're your home for news, sports, weather, and your home for the Phillies, News Radio 1070 WKOK, Sunbury.